This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's plenty at stake for computer users and the computer industry in the Microsoft antitrust case. But let's face it, the case has dragged on for so long, it's been hard to keep up with it. So we asked Joseph Nocera to bring us up to date. He's covering the story for Fortune magazine. He's also business commentator for NPR's Saturday Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. Both Microsoft and the government have presented and cross-examined witnesses. That part of the trial wrapped up last month. Closing arguments are set to begin September 21st. Then comes the judge's decision, which may be followed by a lengthy appeal. Now that Nocera has had a couple of weeks away from the courtroom, I asked him to reflect on what's at stake in the trial.
Well, I think the further away you get from it, the more confusing it is. When you're caught up in the moment, when the trial's going on and you're engaged in it, you wind up thinking that this is the most important thing going on in the universe, and certainly it is not. But it is important, and the problem in terms of trying to figure out how important it is that you don't know how it is going to end. So, you know, question number one is, what will the technology industry look like 2 or 3 years down the line? And the answer is, we don't really know. Question number two is, you know, will Microsoft's power, will the power of the Windows operating system, which is what the case has always been about, be diluted just through the sheer change that is taking place in technology with the internet, with other products, or if you didn't have this government intervention, would that power actually be strengthened and allow Microsoft to control even more of the technology industry? And that is what the case has always been about, Microsoft's power, Microsoft's ability to control the industry through Windows.
What I'm getting from you is that the playing field has changed so much and is continuing to change at such a rapid pace that in some way some of the issues brought up in the trial might be almost out of date by the time the trial is resolved.
Well, one issue in particular, which is very much at the core of the case, is out of date, and that is the issue of browsers. This case began as a case about internet browsers. When Microsoft took its browser, Internet Explorer, and folded it into its operating system, made it a part of its operating system, was that a predatory act that was designed to drive its chief competitor, Netscape, which made a competing browser, Navigator, out of business? That was the issue. If you're looking backward, that's a really important issue. And if you're looking forward, it's a non-issue now. Netscape has now been bought by AOL, and Microsoft's browser now comes as part of the operating system. That's just the way it is. And everyone, I think, who buys computers accepts that. Everyone in the industry accepts that. That's just the deal. And so you wind up thinking, at least I wound up thinking, that much of the importance of this case is defined by whether you're looking back or looking forward. And Microsoft argues strenuously that one should only look forward. And the government, I think, argued equally strenuously, although nobody ever put it like this, is that you have to look past because Microsoft's actions in the past will tell you how they will act in the future. And if you don't change their behavior, they will mold the future the way they want. That the same thing that happened to Netscape will happen to other companies in the future that get into Microsoft's get into Microsoft's sights.
What were some of the government's other most important points in the trial?
Well, it's funny because the trial began as a browser case, and then and very specifically, the government alleged that the act of putting Internet Explorer into Windows was a predatory illegal act, that it was a tie, as they call it. Tying cases, it turns out, as one of the many things I learned about antitrust law, tying cases are very difficult for the government to win. It's like saying that when car manufacturers put car radios into cars, which is also a form of tying. You're tying a product, a radio, into a car. That's a predatory illegal act designed to drive the radio manufacturers out of business. Well, nobody would buy that. So what happened was there was a Court of Appeals decision in June that was tangentially related to the government's action, which pretty much said to the government, if you keep going down this tying road, you are going to lose the case. So the government had a couple of paragraphs in their complaint against Microsoft that kind of, it was a kitchen sink, couple of kitchen sink paragraphs that just basically said, you know, they've taken other predatory actions too. And so what the government did between June, when that Court of Appeals decision came down, and October, when the case began, was they really tried to shift the focus of the case from just a Netscape case to Netscape being one of a series of actions that shows that Microsoft is a monopolist that uses its Windows monopoly to force other companies to take actions that are Microsoft's best interest, but not necessarily in the consumer's best interest or in the industry's best interest. And so instead of just being revolving around Netscape, Netscape was certainly a big part of the case. You had representatives from Apple saying that Microsoft forced them to do things they didn't want to do. You had somebody from Intel, which is Microsoft's great ally, coming forward and giving a very specific example of a case where Microsoft came in and said, we want you to shut down this project because we view this project as anti-Microsoft, which Intel did. You had people from Sun Microsystems coming in and saying, Microsoft is trying to do with the Java technologies. Java, as you know, is the computer language for the internet, that Microsoft's trying to do the same thing with Java that they did with Netscape. And so you had these series of companies coming forward and saying, see, Netscape isn't an isolated example. They've done it to us. They've done it to Intel. They've done it to Sun. And so you have a whole range of predatory practices, according to the government, that show, what the government's really trying to show is that Microsoft's behavior needs to be constrained. And the whole case revolved around, you know, is Microsoft's behavior so predatory, so bad, so monopolistic that it has to be changed?
What did you think was Microsoft's best defense of itself?
Microsoft had one, I think, very compelling defense, and they consistently said, "Where is the consumer harm? Show me where this is a bad thing." And that was pretty powerful. The government economist Franklin Fisher from MIT actually wound up saying that he couldn't see any particular consumer harm in Microsoft's actions, which was devastating, and he wound up coming back on the stand as a rebuttal witness in no small part so he could contradict himself and try and list all the ways there was consumer harm. But, you know, antitrust law has evolved in such a way that it's pretty pro-big company, and it's pretty hard to make a serious antitrust case against a big company. And that's in large part because judges now do not necessarily take the position that big is always bad and that a dominant company needs to be broken up. The whole focus now has become about consumer. Is the beneficiary of the action a consumer, or is the consumer hurt? And if you can't show consumer harm, chances are you're going to win the case. And the government did try to find examples of consumer harm, but really that was Microsoft's strongest argument.
So what were the examples of consumer harm?
Well, you know, this sort of gets you into the realm of the theoretical. In the instances of consumer harm, the government couldn't really say, well, consumers are paying higher prices for Windows than they would have otherwise, because you can't really prove that, you can't really show that. So it would really have to do with, what they really would have to say was, consumers were deprived of choices they might otherwise had if Microsoft was a more benign corporation, and other competitors weren't so afraid of doing things that stepped on its toes. And that's really, you know, you can buy that argument or you cannot buy it. And I actually think the judge in this case is going to buy the government's argument. But he by the end, he was pretty much showing his cards that he was going to rule against Microsoft, and I think he will. But the honest answer is the government couldn't really show tangible consumer harm, but it was more like, well, Intel was putting out this technology that might have been better for consumers if Microsoft hadn't forced it to shut it down. But we don't really know that for a fact because it never got to market.
Right. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Nocera, and he's editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, and he's been covering the Microsoft trial for Fortune. He's also a regular business commentator for Saturday Weekend Edition on NPR. Joe, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about the Microsoft trial and its repercussions. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Nocera. He's editor-at-large at Fortune magazine, and he's been covering the Microsoft trial for Fortune. He's also a regular business commentator for Saturday Weekend Edition on NPR. In the journal that you've been writing for Fortune, you about the Microsoft trial, you've pointed out that one of the more, just funny things that happened at the trial was that Microsoft, in trying to prove that it doesn't have a monopoly and isn't totally bullying its competitors, was basically advertising its competitors' strengths and trying to show how strong its competitors really were, basically doing ads on behalf of its competitors.
It's true. It was funny. It was weird. Not only would they do them from the stand, they would actually produce videos. The one that really stands out in my mind is one for Linux, which is a competing operating system that is just beginning to emerge. And there'd be like a narrator, and he'd say, you know, we want to show the court how easy it is to use the Linux operating system, and they'd run it, and it'd say, you know, look, it has a browser, and you'd think, just like Windows, and they'd say, look, you can get email, and a reporter sitting behind me after one of these videos, you know, he leaned over and he said, I wonder if they can use that as a product endorsement. there was much about this trial that was surreal.
What else?
You had the whole video thing going, which, they would introduce the videos all the time. But then you would also have this stuff where you'd have these incredibly inflammatory, nasty emails that the government had gotten from Microsoft's files. Many of them, by the way, written by Bill Gates, which was the most surreal thing of the whole trial, which we'll get to in a minute. And you'd have a top Microsoft executive on the stand, and the email would say something like, you know, I do not want us to work with Sun. They're the enemy. We want to kill them. They aren't, you know. And David Boies, the government prosecutor, would look at the witness and say, now, it looks to me like he's saying, we want to put them out of business. Is that how you read the matter? And the witness would say, oh, no. He didn't mean that at all. He meant, we just want to look for ways that we can cooperate with them because we think they're the greatest software company in the world. And everybody would burst out laughing. The judge would roll his eyes. Boies, who was the government prosecutor, would turn around with his big grin on his face. And then you had the whole Bill Gates deposition, which dominated the first portion of the trial and was by far the most surreal thing I have ever seen in my entire life.
Well, let me just point out something obvious here, which is, you know, in the same period of time when we had the now famous Bill Clinton video deposition, you know, you were watching the Bill Gates video deposition.
Right. And as a matter of fact, the whole impeachment thing was going on at the same time as the Microsoft trial. We were kind of Microsoft trial snobs. Those of us covering the trial, we thought we were, you know, we were the highbrows, and those lowbrows were up there on Capitol Hill covering the impeachment
sex.
Hearing.
That's right.
That's right.
You were above that.
No, we didn't talk about sex. We talked about market share. And on some level, there wasn't that much difference. They would show these videos. You know, they had taken 20 hours of video with Bill Gates. And David Boies actually told me later that after the first day of the video, of the deposition, which he conducted in Seattle, he came back and to his hotel and told his troops that this was, you know, he couldn't have had it. Asked for a better deposition because it was so awful. And they knew that they would be able to play it in court and Bill Gates would look like an idiot, which of course he's not. But he turned the whole thing into a word game exercise. And so Boyes, David Boyes would say, you know, what is the market share of Internet Explorer, your browser? And he'd say, market share? What's market share? And it was really on that level. And once they actually got into a 10-minute debate over the phrase pissing on.
What was the debate?
Where there was an email. It, you know, somebody had written Gates a memo saying, you know, we're going to piss on them. You know, if they get out of line, we're going to piss on them, something like that. And it took Boyes 10 minutes to get Gates to concede that the phrase was did not mean let's be nice to them.
Why did Microsoft feel that Bill Gates shouldn't testify in person in court and should rather just do a video deposition?
Well, you know, as part of any lawsuit, you always depose everybody who's involved, whether they're going to be a potential witness or not. And then you decide, you know, based, you know, who's going to be your witnesses and who's just going to put in deposition testimony and so on. So there was never a question of whether he was going to be deposed or not. The question was, could he have changed the dynamics of the case by deciding to testify? And it's never been clear to me why they didn't want him to testify, except perhaps because his deposition was so bad that Boyes would have had a field day going back to his deposition and saying, but didn't you say this? Didn't you say this? And sort of showing him up as a liar, which you know, you have to remember the government got really lucky in its choice of prosecutors. It was able to hire the finest corporate litigator in America today to handle its case. This is not a somebody who's been in the... this guy is great. And he made every witness look bad. And he would have made Bill Gates look bad. Having said all that, I still believe that the only way... There came a point when it was clear that Microsoft was losing the case, when it was just getting killed every day at court. And I came to believe that there came a point when the only way Microsoft was going to save itself would be to put Bill Gates on the stand and have him say, you know, have him be the real Bill Gates, not the Bill Gates engaged in a word game exercise with a government prosecutor, and have him look at the judge and say, Your Honor, you're right. It was a terrible deposition, and you know, I handled it badly. I didn't lie outright, but I handled it badly, but let me tell you about the real Microsoft and the real competition we face and all the good we've done and the importance of Windows being the operating system standard. And I to this day, it baffles me that Microsoft did not choose to do that. But then when you look at their defense, they were, you know, much of it was ultimately extremely baffling.
You obviously were very impressed with David Boyes, who was the government's chief prosecutor. What was so impressive about him?
Well, he is, I think, the legal equivalent of a jazz musician. He has a phenomenal memory. So he has, in his mind, he knows where all the evidence is, and he can sort of pluck it when he needs it. He's very theatrical. So you're always paying attention to him. You never feel bored. And he's willing to take risks. There's a legendary story about him that he was defending a company in a contract dispute, and he got the lead witness for the other side on the stand, and his first question, which he thought was a pro forma question, was, "Have you read the contract?" And the witness said, "No." And this is a contract dispute. And he looked at the judge and he said, "I have no further questions, Your Honor." And he did some very similar things in the Microsoft trial. There was one, the classic example is when a witness, there's a very important Netscape-Microsoft meeting where Netscape alleged that Microsoft tried to divide the market, which is illegal, and Microsoft denies it. And so the lead Microsoft person in that meeting is on the stand, and Boyes has ripped him up one side and down the other, and he has been more or less resuscitated on redirect by the Microsoft lawyer. And Boyes gets up to do his recross. So he's got one more chance to sort of damage his credibility before the guy gets off the stand. And the guy they start talking about something else, and the guy says something that's clearly not true, although it's a negligible point, but it's clearly not true. And Boyes just looks up at him and he says, "You don't believe that, do you, sir? You're just making that up." And the guy said, And then, of course, Boyes knew exactly where the document was that proved that he was lying, and he handed it to him. And the guy didn't even wait for a question. He just said, he said, "I stand corrected." And Boyes said, "I have no further questions." And the guy went off the stand, and, you know, I'd be surprised if he's still at Microsoft.
Joseph Nocera is editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. We'll talk more about the Microsoft trial in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joseph Nocera. We're talking about the Microsoft antitrust case. Closing arguments are scheduled to begin September 21st. Nocera is covering the trial for Fortune magazine. He's also business commentator for NPR's Saturday Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. So what's next in the Microsoft trial?
Well, we still have a long way to go. The judge, his name is Thomas Penfield Jackson, who was actually, a pretty good judge, has devised, I think, a very clever scheme to try and force the two sides to settle. We haven't talked about that much. There have been several kind of half-hearted attempts to settle the case that have gotten nowhere because the two sides are so far apart on what they think needs to be done as a remedy for Microsoft. Microsoft thinks it really needs just a tiny little slap on the wrist, and the government basically believes that the Windows operating system needs to be neutered, for lack of a better word. But the judge has done something extremely unusual. He has set up a system where there will be two closing arguments. And I've never heard of this before. One is going to be a series of closing arguments just on the facts. And then he's going to rule on the facts. And that will be the factual disputes. Did Microsoft attempt to divide the market or not with Netscape? You know, did they try and shut down Intel's project or not? So there'll be a factual closing argument phase, and then he'll rule on the facts, and then there'll be a law closing arguments phase, and he'll rule on the law. And I believe the reason he's done it this way is so that he can show his hand on the facts without having to make a final decision on the law, thus helping everybody move towards a settlement, which I think is what he really wants.
What do you think he wants, a settlement as opposed to a decision?
A decision is fraught with a certain kind of peril. Suppose almost everybody believes that he will rule against Microsoft. He actually used the word monopoly a couple of times towards the end of the case. And so he rules that Microsoft is a monopoly that has abused its monopoly power. Then what? What do you do about it? That has always been the real sticking point of this case. Nobody really can talk about what the remedy should be because nobody really knows what an appropriate remedy will be. Nobody involved in the case believes that Microsoft should be broken up as a result of this case because the evidence just isn't strong enough to justify that kind of remedy. But short of that, Windows is a standard in the computer business, and it's not going to go away. And Microsoft owns the intellectual property rights to that standard. And you can't take away its intellectual property. It's just the most baffling aspect of the case. What do you do about it? And I think the judge wants to avoid two things. One, he would like to avoid being overruled by the Court of Appeals, which may or may not happen, but that's a certain peril for him. And second of all, I don't think he really wants to try and figure out what to do because it's so fraught with peril. It's just really, really hard to figure out. Also, you know, there may be a new president by the time this case is settled, and who knows how he feels about the Microsoft case. And there are all these, you know, imponderables, and a settlement just kind of wipes that all off the table. It gets it off the books, and you can, if you're the judge, you go on to the next case.
Do you think that this trial is having an impact on how the computer business world is proceeding?
Oh, you bet. No question. Even if Microsoft were to win the case, its behavior has already been constrained. I don't know if you remember the famous IBM 13-year antitrust case, which by the way is where David Boies made his reputation defending IBM, ironically enough. But the great upshot of that case is the government dropped it in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan became president. But by the time the case was dropped, IBM's monopoly power had disappeared because all the behaviors that the government was trying to change had changed. Because they feared the government and because of the case. Well, that's already happening with Microsoft. Computer manufacturers, who are the ones who really are under Microsoft's thumb, have much more freedom today than they had when this case started to set up their computers the way they want, to offer Netscape as an alternative to Internet Explorer. Dell actually will load a Sun operating system onto its computers if you ask for it. It's hard to believe that they would be allowed to do that. They would be allowed to do that if Microsoft was not under attack by the government. There's a second way, I believe, that it's changing the computer industry, which is that, here we have this giant explosion in the Internet. Yahoo, AOL, Amazon.com. Where is Microsoft in this Internet business? The answer is they're nowhere to be found. They have the browser and they have the Microsoft network, but they're not really big the way a Yahoo is or an Amazon is. They're not in the auction. There's all these businesses that they're not in, but which they could buy their way into in 5 minutes if they wanted to. And I firmly believe, I've talked to some CEOs, I've talked to some people involved in Internet companies, and they believe that the reason Microsoft is not making a full-fledged assault on these Internet businesses is because they're worried about the government, how the government will react.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonah Serra, you have been a guest on Fresh Air several times in the past, and I usually end our interviews by asking you something about the stock market, which you've been following and writing about for years. Now, over the past few years, when we end our conversations, you've warned that the stock market, although it's been going up...
not going to do that.
might at any moment really disappoint people, especially those who are new to the stock market. So, where are you now?
Well, Terry, I have a very elegant way of putting this. I call myself a behavioral bear, which is that people don't necessarily behave rationally about the market even when it's going up. And so, see, you're probably losing money. No. where am I now? I'm in the stock market just like everybody else, and I have to be there just like everybody else. But I'm not in Internet stocks. I believe that the Internet is a really important and powerful phenomenon. It may change the way most businesses are done. I believe all of that, but I don't necessarily believe that these stocks in particular can stay where they are. I do believe that with the Internet, we are in a sort of a mania phase, and even the companies that will turn out to be real, and certainly AOL is one of those, but Yahoo is probably one, and eBay and a handful of others, CNET, I believe that those stocks will eventually come down to earth. I mean, they're at price-earnings ratios of over 1,000, where the market in general is at price-earnings ratios of 35 to 40. So, as for the rest of the market, I throw up my hands. I say it doesn't make any sense particularly. We are in a good economy and inflation is certainly under control and interest rates are low. But, corporate earnings are not what they were 3 or 4 years ago. And you just wind up thinking it's hard to understand completely what is driving this market. And I guess as somebody who does follow this and cover this and will continue to write about it, I have basically thrown up my hands and saying I can't figure it out and I'm going to stop trying.
Well, I think that's actually very rational.
Thank you.
Well, Joseph Nocera,
if I come on in two years and it's at 15,000, please don't ask me this again.
I'm not promising anything.
All right.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot for talking with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks a lot, Terry.
Joseph Nocera is editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. This is Fresh Air.